This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. For an entire decade, the United States government seemed possessed with the fate of one small nation that divided the Atlantic from the Pacific, Nicaragua. In 1977, a young freelancer named Stephen Kinzer got a press card from Tiny Pacific News Service and caught a plane for Nicaragua. By 1983, he had been hired by the New York Times. Last year, he finally left. Now, with the revolutionary Sandinistas out of power, Nicaragua has all but vanished from the North American horizon. In a remarkably detailed personal account, Kinzer has written about his 13-year love affair with Nicaragua. He calls it Blood of Brothers, Life and War in Nicaragua. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You say you're trying to bring Americans to some understanding of the people who live and make up Nicaragua. But you also seem to be coming to terms with yourself as a young man who would be a great journalist in a country that has a long history with the United States.
It was obviously a difficult situation to be an American reporting from a country where the United States was sponsoring a war. But the Nicaraguans welcomed me, and I think sometimes I was actually surprised at how little hostility they seemed to show to individual Americans. They opened themselves up in a way that many people in the United States and more sophisticated or developed countries never do. I felt a warmth and a love from Nicaraguans that I felt in very few other places I've ever visited. This is something else I try to bring across in my book, that the ordinary Nicaraguan had a story to tell, which was never told in the United States. We were always told that Nicaragua was under the rule of a brutal, cruel government, or if you were listening to the other side, that they were under the rule of humanistic socialists. But we were never brought beyond the political debate. When you are reporting on a war from Washington, as many people did during the Nicaraguan War, you see it only as a conflict of ideologies and a political conflict. What I'm trying to do in my book is not make a final judgment about who was right and who was wrong, but rather to help people understand the motivations that all the different factions and all the different leaders were feeling. It's not an attempt to reach a judgment. It's an attempt to help people understand.
You certainly you attempt to avoid, as you say, casting judgments on the politics of the country. But it's pretty clear that the Somoza dynasty was pretty abhorrent to you.
The Somoza dictatorship was cruel and brutal. The most...
You call him, or you quote someone else as describing Anastasio Somoza as a combination of Caligula and Dale Carnegie.
He had managed to persuade the government of the United States that it was all right to support his dictatorship because he was a friend of the United States and that he could maintain a country under his thumb and make sure that the United States always had a reliable ally there. That was really all that Washington was interested in. But those of us who had a chance to visit Nicaragua during the time Somoza was in power, and unfortunately there were very few American journalists who did that, saw another side of the Somoza dictatorship. Not only was he a cruel dictator, but he was a person devoted fanatically to his own personal gain. The Somoza family, during 40 years of ruling Nicaragua, stole everything they could get their hands on. The Somoza family became the wealthiest family in Nicaraguan history and thereby earned the opprobrium of their entire nation. At the time when the Sandinistas began their first major offensive against the Somozas in the late 1970s, virtually the entire population was ready to join any movement that was going to oust the dictatorship. And it was really the cruelty and the brutality and the corruption of the Somoza dictatorship that created the conditions that permitted the Sandinistas to come to power.
And the Sandinistas are problematical for a lot of Americans. Certainly on the left, people wanted to see them as heroes not only in Nicaragua, but for all of Latin America, sort of throwing off this this decrepit history. And but what how did you come to see Sandinismo.
At the beginning, naturally, the anti-American aspect of the Sandinista Front was very understandable. The United States had played an ignoble role in Nicaragua over many decades. It was natural that a movement that was rebelling against the dictatorship, a dictatorship that was supported by the United States, would be anti-American. Nonetheless, when the Sandinistas came to power, they were supported by a wide range of civilian groups. They were supported by political parties, by trade unions, even by business organizations. It seemed that they were part of a broad coalition. But as the months passed after they came to power, we came to see that wasn't true. The five-member junta that the Sandinistas established to run Nicaragua soon realized that it really didn't have any power at all. And therefore, the junta split. Two of its members quit and became vituperatively anti-Sandinista. One of them, in fact, went on to become president of Nicaragua today. That's Violeta Chamorro. The problem is not that the Sandinistas took up arms rather than trying to come to power by peaceful means. The problem was what happened after they came to power. They had destroyed the machinery of the dictatorship, but then, instead of trying to build a broad-based government, they fell back on their own ideology and therefore limited, really, the amount that they were able to do for Nicaragua.
Why do you think that was so? What was the appeal of revolutionary Marxism for these mostly men, young men, highly educated, from the upper classes in Nicaragua? Why do you think that that happened?
There are several reasons. First of all, the concept of democracy became polluted in Nicaragua, as in much of Latin America. The Somoza dictatorship, like many other dictatorships in Latin America, cloaked itself in the rhetoric of democracy. They wrapped themselves in the American flag, and they held regular elections all the time, and they maintained what seemed to be a democratic structure on the surface. Everyone who lived there, however, could see that this was a phony democracy and that these elections never meant anything. They were only tools by which the dictatorship maintained its power. Therefore, revolutionaries in Nicaragua became very soured on the idea of democracy, on the idea of elections. They had seen these ideas used as ways to prop up a dictatorship, and they were looking for alternatives to that. Another factor had to do with their admiration for Fidel Castro. Castro had led the only successful revolution in Latin America up until the time the Sandinistas took over. During the entire 20 years that the Sandinistas were fighting for power, Castro was their hero. And when they came to power, they sought to duplicate Cuba. They sought to build a regime and a government and a society in Nicaragua that would approximate what Castro had done in Cuba. Finally,
is that so unreasonable given what they could look around Central America and see on these sort of basic bread and butter issues of housing and health and literacy and all of that? Is it so surprising that Cuba would seem appealing?
Cuba had much to offer in the way of an example to Nicaragua. However, the errors of the Cuban government and the insistence of the Cuban leadership in maintaining the country under a single ideological rule was something that was really not applicable to Nicaragua. I always felt that the Sandinistas were not revolutionary enough, if you want to put it in these terms, that the kind of government they installed in Nicaragua was not a radical enough departure from that of the old dictatorship. They believed that they knew what was best for Nicaragua. They believed that all of their enemies were traitors. And they believed that their ideology was the one that held the key to Nicaragua's progress. This was what ruling groups in Latin America had believed for centuries. It would have been more revolutionary for the Sandinistas to break with the pattern of Castro, to break with the pattern of regimes both of the left and of the right, and to try to introduce a fully open and fully pluralistic society in Nicaragua. They never went that far. They provided the basis for the emergence of a regime that did go that far, but they themselves, I think, were trapped in an ideology that emerged in the late 1950s and early 1960s and were never successful in modernizing it to adapt it to the Nicaragua of the 1980s.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer, New York Times reporter who spent many years in Nicaragua and has written a new book called The Blood of Brothers, Life and War in Nicaragua. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Stephen Kinzer is my guest. He spent more than a decade in Nicaragua watching the revolution against the Somoza dictatorship and what he sees as the steady souring of the Sandinista promise. You talk in the book about the relations between the Sandinistas and the Miskito Indians, and you tell a story of a child who seemed to have been killed and came back to life almost. Can you tell us what that is and what that might tell us about Sandinista Nicaragua?
The Miskito Indians and the way the Miskito Indians were treated by the Sandinistas was an area that particularly interested me. I spent a lot of time in the Miskito Indian homeland and came to develop a special affection for the Miskitos. They suffered particularly from the arrogance of the Sandinistas. Like almost all Spanish-speaking Nicaraguans, the Sandinistas knew nothing about the Miskito Indians. The Indians had lived in a part of Nicaragua for centuries that was completely cut off from the mainstream of Nicaraguan life and had developed patterns of life very different from those of Spanish-speaking Nicaraguans. The Sandinistas, however, arrived there with no understanding of this culture, this rich history of and rich tradition, and tried to impose their style of rule on people who had a very different view of life. It was odd because in some ways the Miskitos were living in a form of true communism in a primitive sense. They farmed on communal lands and shared most of their properties. But this wasn't good enough for the Sandinistas. They insisted on telling the Miskito Indians, just like they told people in other parts of Nicaragua, what crops they should grow, who they should sell them to, how much money they should charge for them, where they should fish, where they should hunt. And naturally, the Indians bridled at these efforts. The Miskito Rebellion and the vigor with which the Sandinistas moved to suppress it aroused the conscience of the world and wound up, in my judgment, being one of the greatest mistakes the Sandinistas made. They failed to appreciate the culture and identity of Nicaraguan Indians and inflicted on them the greatest trauma in their tribal history.
Well, you were somewhat baffled and intrigued as well by these cultural rituals. There was this incident that seemed to be an almost like a mystical curing, except it didn't make sense.
I open the chapter in my book about the Miskito Indians by describing a strange incident that I never was really able to understand. I arrived in a tiny little Miskito Indian village and suddenly heard a shrieking mother running up from the riverbank with what seemed to be a dead child in her hands, in her arms. It turned out that this child had been bitten, apparently by an insect, and the whole side of the child's face was swollen up, and the child was totally lifeless to all appearances. The mother was completely distraught. Other villagers gathered around in horror. There, of course, was nothing even resembling medical care in a remote village like this, and nobody knew what to do, including me. Suddenly, a young woman emerged from the crowd of villagers and went over to this child, kneeled down over him, and began chanting in strange syllables that were not Spanish and were also not the Miskito language. Then she produced flower petals from inside one of her pockets and began sprinkling these petals over the baby. And she was chanting as if she was trying to coax some kind of evil spirit out of that baby's body. This went on for 10 or 15 minutes. She slapped the baby a few times on its chest, sprinkled more flower petals, and chanted more. Everybody held their breath and wondered what was going on. And then suddenly, to our astonishment, the baby opened his eyes and started to cry. And the mother, who had been sobbing in anguish over what she thought was the death of her child, shrieked for joy, grabbed the baby, and everybody that was watching was stunned. None of us could understand how this had happened. Later on, I went over to this woman and asked her if she was some kind of a healer or if she was some kind of a mystic who had learned some ancient traditions or some ancient rituals from forebears. She just laughed and said, "Oh, no, I'm no healer, I'm no mystic. I don't really know anything about what just happened. I can't explain it myself, but I was in a refugee camp for several years, and I saw some people there who were healers, and they chanted, and they used these flower petals, so I thought maybe I could do the same thing, and sure enough, it worked. Later on, I tried to understand what had happened and how that had worked, and I never was able to figure it out."
Has that incident produced a certain amount of at least caution in your faith in conventional explanations of how the world works?
Certainly when you work in Latin America, particularly in Nicaragua, you find that there is no single truth. There is no answer to every question. There's a great tendency, particularly on the part of Americans, to want to find out quickly who's right, who's wrong, who's telling the truth, who's lying, and what the real explanation is. That is a cultural bias that slowly I had to lose in my years in Nicaragua. I had to understand that people who were arguing with each other might both be right. And it was a difficult thing, I think, for an American to assimilate. I think it was more important for journalists who were covering Nicaragua to help Americans understand this country than it was for us to try to tell Americans very specifically who was right and who was wrong.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Stephen Kinzer, New York Times reporter, whose new book is called The Blood of Brothers, Life and War in Nicaragua. I was struck by something fairly early on in your book about the press. We have this notion that all of the media are fiercely competitive with one another, jealous of their sources, don't give over facts. And yet, at one point, you were living in a house with a reporter from Time, another from the Washington Post, another from the New York Times, the Washington Star, and the Journal du Brasil. And you almost, it sounds as though you almost set up a kind of a press bureau and you gave each other assignments. And the end of the day, you sort of corroborated each other's stories and then you filed your pieces. This is surely not what we tend to think as the way it's done.
Journalists have to adapt to circumstances, particularly when they're working abroad. The period that you're talking about was the period of the Sandinista uprising. We had a war going on all over Nicaragua. It was impossible to think that one person could find out each day the major events that had taken place in the war and then write a story about that. Each of us, at best, was able only to see the smallest piece of what was happening. I was living in a house at that time with a group of other reporters, and we agreed among ourselves to divide up our tasks. One would go and try to find out what the National Guard and the forces of the dictatorship were planning. Another would try to find Sandinistas and see what they were planning. Someone else would go out and travel to different towns outside of Managua and see if we could find out the progress of the war on the ground. It was only this way that we were able to piece together a possibly accurate view of what was happening. There is a danger, of course, that when reporters are sitting around the table together every night, they begin to think that what they say to each other is more important than what they hear from people out in the street. That's a danger to guard against, and that's the reason why, during my years in Nicaragua, I spent most of my time in my Jeep roaming around the countryside and trying to meet the people who were really being most affected by both the Sandinista government policies and the Contra War. It was those people who were really the basis of my reporting, and while I was always anxious to be in contact with other reporters and to measure my observations against theirs, I never lost sight of the fact that it was the ordinary poor Nicaraguans who really had the story to tell.
When Violeta Chamorro came to this country in the winter and spoke to Congress, Senator Jesse Helms, probably the most vocal, one of the most vocal spokesmen for the Contras, didn't even show up.
I find it very distressing to see how quickly the United States has turned its back on Nicaragua. We are responsible for the destruction of the Nicaraguan economy. Whether or not one supported the Contras, one can now say that we spent hundreds of millions of dollars in a war aimed specifically at burning farms and blowing up factories and crippling the Nicaraguan economy. Now we have finally achieved the result that we hoped for. We have a pro-American, pro-capitalist government in Nicaragua. Yet we are refusing to give it the aid that it needs to solidify itself. This is particularly upsetting because Mrs. Chamorro, for the first time, is trying to build a broad-based government in Nicaragua, something that has never been done before. In Nicaragua, it has always been traditional that the group in power monopolizes 100% of the power and the others get zero. And the only way to come back to power is to rebel. Mrs. Chamorro is trying to break with that pattern by inviting some Sandinistas into her government and consulting with Sandinistas as she rules. It's extremely upsetting now to see officials in Washington trying to tell her, you shouldn't be doing that, and trying to withhold, essentially, aid for her because they don't approve of the details of the way she's governing. This is just what the United States has been doing in Nicaragua for this whole century, trying to govern Nicaragua itself and replace the judgment of its own leaders with our judgment. We have now a situation in Nicaragua where there's a tremendous amount of political freedom, but there is great economic difficulty that threatens all the political progress that's been made there.
I want to thank you for being with us, Stephen Kinzer. Stephen Kinzer is the author of Blood of Brothers, Life and War in Nicaragua. This is Fresh Air.